This is X. Ann Anderson, and welcome to the Principal Podcast today. Today, I am so thrilled to have Ed Hajim with us today. You know, Ed Hajim, he's the son of a Syrian immigrant. He's a seasoned Wall Street executive. He's got more than 50 years of investment experience, and he's held senior management positions with the Capital Group, with EF Hutton, with Lehman Brothers, before becoming the CEO of Furman Seltz. Yeah, I got to say this, in 2008, after 20 years as a trustee of the University of Rochester, Hajim, Ed, began an eight-year tenure as chairman of the university's board. Upon assuming that office, he gave a gift of $30 million, the largest single donation in history, to support scholarships and endow their engineering and applied sciences department. So, Ed, I'm so grateful to have you on the show. Welcome.
It's my privilege. Thank you, Ray, for having me.
One of the reasons I was so thrilled to have Ed on the show is Ed has had this experience of going from an orphanage as a young child to the boardroom. He's written some books, and he has a phenomenal story. Ed, tell us a little bit about your story. This going from the orphanage to the boardroom. Can you tell us about yourself?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of a thumbnail. I want you to read the book, though. You know, that's how...
Of course.
It started when when I was born. I was born to an unemployed father and a homemaker mother. And my father lost all his money in 29. That's a whole other story. But anyway, after 3 years, because of his personality, because he couldn't find a job, my mother divorced my father and took me from Los Angeles, where we were living, to St. Louis, where her parents were. We weren't terribly, you know, they weren't terribly happy with her, because in 1939, nobody needed two more mouths to feed. Dad got $5 a week in alimony and child support and visiting on Sundays. So he drove the 1,800 miles, took him 3 days to visit me on Sunday. And instead of taking me to the movies or to park, he basically took me back to Los Angeles, kidnapping me, and told my mother never to look for us, and subsequently told me that my mother died. That's another story, too, which I believed for nearly 60 years. Anyway, for the next 15 years, for the first couple of years, my father and I lived together, although he was a merchant marine on board a ship. So I stayed. I didn't have a family. I stayed with friends or with neighbors or people like that. When the war broke out, he was drafted into the military. So I ended up in the Catholic welfare system and spent the war in five different Catholic foster homes, which varied between, you know, cold and abusive to warm and caring. After the war ended, Dad flew me back to the East Coast. We spent the summer in the YMCA on 34th Street, and then a hotel room in Coney Island. He was hoping to find land-based work. He didn't, so he had to go back to sea, and I was placed in an orphanage in Far Rockaway. And I did pretty well there after the rites of passage. But 3 years passed, and I aged out of that particular orphanage. My father completely disappeared, which is another very long story. I became a ward of the state, and some wonderful social worker got me into another orphanage in Yonkers, New York, which was right close to a very fine public high school. And I got an epiphany that if I went to a private college, I could probably get out of my predicament. And I did well at that school. I was a varsity athlete and did well in math and science. And there were only three or four scholarships at the time. And the ones I thought I would get, I didn't get, but I did get the NRPC scholarship. And that allowed me to go to the University of Rochester. And that basically set me on my way. And as you know, as you said, within 50 years, I was able to be the chairman of the board of trustees of my alma mater, and I was able to give the largest gift in their 150-year history. It was quite an experience for me, and I did give it for scholarships, because scholarships changed my life, and so that's where I've spent most of my philanthropy. I'll stop that right there, because my daughter works for TED Talks, and she says, I always answer the questions too long, so I've got to do it right this time.
Well, I think we appreciate the answer there, so that's great. Let me ask you this, as you say this, and in your book, The Road Less Traveled, there are some things to talk about. I think in one point you said, my childhood disadvantages became advantages.
Absolutely.
You know, tell us about how they became advantages in later life.
Think about it. You know, when you go from, you know, five different foster homes when you're between 6 and 10 years old, and you go to five different Catholic schools, all right, what happens? You become quite adaptable. In fact, you go from one schoolyard to the next, you learn how to find your place pretty quickly, or else. I mean, you go from one side of the continent to the other. You're adaptable to the East Coast, to the West Coast, to orphanages. You know, all my life I've been very adaptable. When E.F. Hutton, when I was working there, somebody wanted to go to Japan, I went to Japan. When I was at Hutton Lehman Brothers, they said, take on this terrible division. I took it on because I was very adaptable. It also gives you resilience. It's a muscle. And if you use it more, use it as a child, the more it gives you perseverance. It gives you a little man on your shoulder or somebody on your shoulder saying, yeah, you could do this. And it's very important that those disadvantages. Now, you get some disadvantages, too, but you get advantage from these disadvantages. You get certain ones. I was angry. It took me many years to really, you know, get rid of that. But it took a while. But most of the things that I did in my youth became significant advantages throughout my life. I became very much, I appreciated everything I ever had. You know, unfortunately, when you get everything, you don't appreciate the things you do get. I mean, I get a kick out of the fact that when I went to University of Rochester, the food wasn't very good. It was better than the food at the orphanage. So no, that was
right,
you know,
right.
And so you appreciate the next step. So all these disadvantages, and I find today's kids, and including mine, grow up in fine neighborhoods, don't have to overcome anything. So when they get out into the real world, they have anxieties because they've never overcome anything. I mean, there was very little in my life that was any more difficult than what I overcame as a child. Fascinating.
Being kidnapped, being in a foster care situation in multiple places. You said you were living in 15 to 20 different locations, and you had some situations that were tough, that were hostile, that were abusive, and yet somehow you're stronger and better off. And, you know, as you say this, Ed, I've got to say, you know, I sometimes think in life we think we have all these challenges, and if we could just get rid of these challenges. But in reality, sometimes it's these challenges that make us who we are, that make us strong. In your situation here, you were kidnapped in foster care, having to do a lot of stuff on your own. And now you've found a way to make that challenge, that pain, into your superpower. You know what I mean?
That's exactly what happens. It's like a muscle. You used it as a child. You didn't know you were doing that. But when you got through certain things, you ended up with that strength. That voice inside you that said, you know, you've done it, you can do it, you know. And the Catholic Church helped me a little bit too. The Catholic schools were, you know, they gave me some of the real principles. They said, you know, here's the golden rule, you got to follow that. But more importantly, they said, you know, if you do the right things, you're going to end up in this good place. If you do the wrong things, you'll end up in the other place. So, you know, as a child, that sort of embedded something in me that if I did the good things, I could get there. But in really many respects, these disadvantages as a child become advantages. They really do. And if you don't overcome those things, that's why I argue strongly with my friends who live, obviously now I live in very fine neighborhoods. I said, what can we do? We can't send our kids to an orphanage. No. Make them uncomfortable. Send them to Knowles. Send them to Outward Bound. Get them a job in a hospital. You know, make sure they work on the summers. Make sure they have some difficulties. Because if they don't, you know, I come to the point that in many respects, there's only two experiences you have. One is success, the other is getting experience. And there's no failure, especially early on. Anyway, you got it exactly right, that overcoming difficulties ends up being an advantage. Malcolm Gladwell speaks about that in one of his books, too, as well.
I love that. And what you just said here is so profound, Ed. For parents who are trying to make it easy for their kids, or they're saying, you know, no, there's no challenge. You're actually doing your children a disservice. It's actually okay to intentionally, I mean, in a non-abusive way, but intentionally make things hard for your kids. Have them do hard things. Have them do things that are difficult for them.
My grandchild went on a Knowles trip to Alaska in 60 days, 30 days in the rain. I mean, that was good for him. You learn how to overcome that. Yeah, exactly. My daughter spent 6 weeks in Baja, California on a trip with six other women in a kayak, and you sleep on the ground for a while, and that's just, you overcome that. You get confidence in yourself. Then when you come across something in the real world, it's not that difficult. You'll get through it. Or even if you don't get through it, you'll say, I can handle this, and you go after it. I find that that's very important. When I interview people, I look at, you know, what they've done in their past and have they really overcome challenges. And you find out those that have tend to be more successful than those that haven't. And that's what the Boy Scouts used to be. You know, they put you through all these badges and all that kind of stuff. I was a Cub Scout, but I never got to be a Boy Scout. But I remember that. And there was things you had to do. And in the service, I mean, the service, I One summer we spent, you know, 3 weeks as a Marine when I was in the NROTC. And then, you know, the 3 weeks were really something. I mean, we up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, carrying logs around, you know, going underneath barbed wire, you know, marching every day. It was really helpful because, you know, that's when you gain confidence in yourself in doing almost anything. So, you know, I find that that's why I say if I had a magic wand, I would have everybody do some service when they got out of high school.
I love that. I think we, and since there are a lot of parents who are listening to this and thinking, like, let's think about this for a second. Sometimes some parents are so anxious to make life so good and so easy for people, you know, the child forgets their lunch and the mom runs it over, the dad runs it over to school. Well, maybe they could just be okay. Like, you know, maybe they just don't get the lunch that day. And unless there's some huge medical reason, but like, if they don't get the lunch, they'll remember the next day to bring the lunch. They'll learn to be self-reliant, right? Or maybe if they forgot their homework, well, tough beans. Let them forget it. Maybe it's okay to say, let's let our kids do hard things. Let's let the, and actually be appreciative because, you know, people go to the gym just to make their body have hard times so they can come back stronger.
Exactly. That's perfect. That's the physical experience as the mental experience. I say to young people, get your kids out of the house, put them on their own as soon as possible. My daughter sends her kids to a camp up in Vermont. The kids sleep in a tent. And when it rains, it ain't so good. That's very healthy. You know?
That's right. But then they learn self-reliance, right? Because they learn how to adapt.
Yeah, they get self-reliance. And then they come back and they have to go to school and have to overcome something. You know, it's not so hard anymore. So yeah, campus, it's a lesser thing. I mean, it's not real exactly, but they have to sleep in a tent. They get up in the morning, pledge allegiance to the flag. By the time they get to in their teens, they go on a 17-day trip in canoes up in the boondocks. So that's, you know, that's just sort of that sort of thing. Outward Bound's got some great, great trips, and so does Knowles. And also working, you know, at a certain age, get them to work where it's understanding that you can do something, you know, and you'll find out who you are by doing that. But as early as possible, I think that's important for young families. And I must admit, I made that mistake. I live in Greenwich, Connecticut. I want to give my kids private school. I'll take them to everything. All of a sudden, I caught myself when my oldest was just turning to be a teenager. I said, whoops, wait a second. You know, what are you doing here? And luckily I did. And I'm a member of YPO, and I heard somebody make some kind of speech about this. So I went home and started to change things just a little bit. Each kid had a job to do. Each kid got paid, you know, based on what he did at the house and so forth. He's a little bit, it's not the real world, but if you can get them out on their own, especially in the summertime in a camp or in a program, that'll be very helpful. So, but it's not easy. It's not easy. I said, I don't blame anybody for their kids' activities because they grew up in a totally different time. I grew up in the Depression, war, the inflation of the 70s, you know, and then for the last 40 years, we've run an unbelievable economy and world, except for 9/11. It's been a very, very wonderful, straight up experience. And that's what they experience. So how the heck can you expect them to understand anything? When it doesn't happen to you, you don't appreciate it.
I love that. And you've even talked about that in your book, On the Road Less Traveled, where you said not, you know, being very poor produced a drive in you to have financial independence and appreciation for financial success. And you've done very well, probably in part because you did experience what it's like to be very poor. And so the pain of the youth, of your youth, became, as we've said before,
there's another experience there too. I made up my mind I was going to have financial security. So you get in the habit of working a little harder than you should. And after a while, you don't know, but you do it all the time. I mean, I always worked a little harder than I should. And that can be bad for you in many respects. But I did have this goal that I was never going to be poor again. And that ended up, at age 47, I made a little bit of a pivot in my life where making money was not as the most important thing, but what really I wanted to do with life. That's why I say to people, save your passions, because at one point in life, you can exercise it. I really wanted to run a company. I left a very prestigious Lehman Brothers fancy office and dining room of the horse, and went to work for a little company called Furman Sales. And my office overlooked the brick wall instead of the harbor. And the dining room was a hot plate in a conference room rather than a fancy dining room with the waiter standing behind you, because that's what I really wanted to do. But I had to wait till my mid-career where I made enough money that I was relatively comfortable. So, you know, because I put financial security near the top of the list. I just never wanted to be poor again. But you do develop habits when you do that. Because when you make a choice in the road, you choose something that's going to, you know, make you financially secure.
So let me ask you a question, Ed. As a young man, how were you able to overcome your challenges?
Three things. I said the Catholic schools, well, first of all, my father, although he abandoned me four times in 18 years, he always supported me. He sent me letters saying, "You're the greatest." He gave me unconditional love and letters and with very some contact. And he also sent me messages, be a good person, do this, do that. So got to start off with that. It's nice to have a parent or somebody who believes in you. The second thing is the Catholic Church made these rules up to, besides, you know, the golden rule, the Ten Commandments, and this idea that if you really did good, you'll be okay. They sent that message and put that in a little kid's head between 6, 8, 7, 8, 9 years old. That sort of sticks with you. And then finally, which is corny, and you'll get a kick out of this. Every Saturday when I was a child, you would go to the movies. And guess who was in the movies? There were heroes there. They always, you know, the good guys, John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, you know, Clark Gable, all those guys in movies in those days were, you know, they were good people and they did good things. They usually smoked a cigarette at the end and when they died, but in the war movies and so forth, but they all were good people. So you had role models that were really good people that you took after. So those are sort of the, and by the way, the only reason I've said these three things is because people like you have asked me this question many times and I sort of have to come up with what really caused me to become the person. They also felt that, you know, I felt that I really wanted the good life. I saw my father didn't have the good life, and I really wanted to have something he didn't have. Also wanted to show him that I could do it. Obviously, he died a little earlier and didn't find out the whole thing, but I got to a certain point. He was proud of the fact that I was able to overcome it, and he supported me all the way through.
Wonderful. Let me ask you this, Ed. You've lived a little bit of a hidden life. Why did you finally decide to tell your story now?
In my early 70s, a couple of things happened. First of all, my wife never knew the whole story. She knew about 75% of them. Kids didn't know more than half of it. And they started pressuring me, you know, especially my daughter, who was a writer and so forth. You know, you really want to know the story. Then I became the chairman of the board of trustees of the University of Rochester, and I wanted to get my gift anonymously. And they said, "Oh, we got to know a lot about you." They started digging. And then finally, Horatio Alger came to me and said, "We'd like to make you a member, but we got to find out the whole story." So I started into writing the book for my family. And as I got into it, I learned that I had really a lot of lessons that I might be able to tell people. When I finished the book, I sent it out to 15 of my friends, and 10 of them came back and said, "You cannot just send this to your friends. This has got to go public." At least 8 or 9 of them said, "Every freshman in the United States ought to read this book, or every senior in high school." So I figured, what the hell? This is my new pivot. I'll just decide to take this thing public and see what happens. And I've started now doing it, and I'm getting a terrific kick out of it. In fact, I've taken it to another level now. I've created a course for seniors in high school and freshmen in college, where instead of, well, let me give back up a little bit. There are two kinds of education in my mind. It was a direct quote by one educator. One is to teach you how to make a living. Second is to teach you how to make a life. We do a reasonable job of school of teaching you how to make a living. We do just a very poor job of teaching you how to make a life. So I created a course where we ask the question, who are you? Where do you want to go? How do you think you might get there? And why do you want to go there? That's the island of the four P's. What is your passion? What are your principles? Who are your partners? And what are your plans? Because in many respects, if I may be so bold, when you're in your first 16, 18 years, you have no control of who you are. You're a combination of your genes and your environment, right? Neither one of those things do you control. But somewhere in that 16, 18, 19 year old, you arrive at a college or a first job, and you finally have control over, or some control over who you are. You decide, what part of me do I want to keep? What part of me do I want to really eliminate or at least cut back? And what parts of me do I want to add? So this is the sort of process I've gone through. And that's why I've done all this. And I've believed in flow. You know, you sort of go in a direction and it sort of takes you in a direction. I keep iterating it. I'm trying to write a third book also, which is going to really focus in on the lessons, the actual lessons. My second book, The Island of the Four P's, is a fable, which I love, because fables trap you into doing your own thinking. And this fable, you know, you read the book, you're thinking about yourself. You're not thinking of what's going on in the book. It's like Gulliver's Travels or Ooh, My Cheese and so on. So that's, again, a long answer, but that's exactly why I decided to write it. But pressure came from the family originally, then circumstance. You know, Rochester would not sit still until they, you know, told the world about who I was. And then erasure alger, that's one of the requirements. And once I did erasure alger, I was out in the public. You know, they 100, 1,200 people. I'm standing on a stage. I'm telling about my, you know, my time in an orphanage and so forth and so on. So it was out there. I figured I'd try it. It looked like it was, that's where the world was taking me. So I'd follow it.
And just to clarify for our listeners, and I probably should have emphasized this, in 2015, Ed received the Horatio Alger Award. It was given to Americans who exemplify the values of initiative, leadership, commitment, excellence, and who've succeeded despite personal adversities, which you clearly have. And that's, so thanks for mentioning that. Well, this idea, this overcoming obstacles thing, especially as a parent, there are a lot of parents who are listening to this. And this idea of intentionally giving our children, letting them have difficult times, like you say, let them go out and camp. And
Make them uncomfortable.
You know, and it reminds me, I'll just tell you a quick story and you can tell me your thoughts on this. My daughter came to me and she said, you know, Dad, I want to hike this mountain. Well, there's a mountain near where we live that's about 11,700 feet tall. It's a huge mountain. And she's 5 years old. She comes to me at 5 years old and says, Dad, I want to hike this mountain. And, you know, part of me as a dad could have easily just said, you know what, you're too young, not going to do it. But she was persistent. And I said, you know, let's talk about this. If you really want to do it, maybe we can let you do it. I said, but what's going to happen when your feet hurt? Because we got to hike about 15 miles and we're going to go thousands and thousands of feet up. What's going to happen to your feet hurt? She goes, well, Dad, I'll take a rest and then we'll keep going. And I said, well, if you really want to try, we'll do it. Well, my 5-year-old daughter did it. I mean, she hiked to the top of this mountain. You've never seen anybody. I mean, when she got to the top, there were people at the top who stood up and gave her a standing ovation. But what the real win was, wasn't that she hiked the mountain, was that because she did something difficult, she now had extra confidence in herself. And I think about that as from your story, Ed. Here's Ed, who had a difficult childhood, kidnapped by his father, in foster care multiple times, moving 15, 20 times, having to go through these things. And yet this inner something in you now, I'm betting you have more confidence in the business world. You have more confidence that you can get things done in life than probably 99.9% of the other people that we know. And it's because you were able to overcome these very difficult things. And so as parents, can we allow our kids to have these difficult things so they can be like Ed? Hey, Jim, right? Hey, like Ed, I'm saying your name correctly, I hope. And allow our children to have difficult things so that their confidence, who they are, becomes stronger.
You've just done something more than I've actually done. You've created a metaphor. Your daughter now has climbed a mountain, which she'll remember the rest of her life. When she starts to climb those other mountains, which aren't 11,000 feet, but are, you know, emotional mountains, physical mountains, business mountains, she'll remember climbing that mountain at 5 years old. Now, you really have created a metaphor for what I'm talking about. Especially, parents should also not only try to make your kids uncomfortable, but try to find ways which they want to be uncomfortable. Like your daughter wanted to climb the mountain. I really want to, you know, kayak. One of my grandsons become a big kayaker. And, you know, he's only 15 years old. See him going down the stream scares me to death. But, you know, that's something he wants to do. He's in control. I think if you have the money, not even doing the money, but you can do it any way possible, teach your kids how to ski, you know, because they have control over their bodies. They're responsible. It's not, you know, it's a little dangerous. It's good. That's good for them, but they're in control. And I also believe in camp or some other experience where the kids live out in the open, you know, where they have to take care of themselves, fold their own clothes, get their own laundry, so forth, and have activities where they've got to be at a certain point in time. Schools, you know, private schools and any schools and so forth, it's a little less challenging than when you're on your own out there in the boondock. So, but you created a metaphor. I think you ought to tell your story, and the 5-year-old child says something and you do it, she'll remember that for a long time, if not forever.
I hope so. And thanks for acknowledging that. Talk about the inner voice. You said, you know, you talk a little bit about how you have this inner voice tell us about the inner voice that
people talk about constants. All right. It's only two constants. It's not death and taxes, because death only happens once, and taxes you don't pay until you're in your 20s or something. There's two constants. One is your inner voice. You have it since you were born till you die. and change. And what I'm trying to do is to give that inner voice a vocabulary. Always ask yourself, what are my passions? What are my passions? Overused word, but what are my interests? What are my likes and what are my dislikes? And you have to put that into a context, whether you're in your New York City or Kiev, that your passions are different. Okay. What are my principles? I want these decisions written down and put into a box so I can go back and study them. Who are my partners? What partners do I need to accomplish what I want to do? And what plans did I write down? You know, now obviously plans have to be changed, but I think writing plans down and saying allows you, especially as young persons, to test something. When I was a freshman, I wrote down that I wanted to be a physicist. So I took an advanced physics course. All the other engineers took regular engineering physics. I took an advanced physics course. And within 6 months, I looked around and said, "Ooh, this isn't for me. You know, this is not my people." So I got out of there in a hurry. And the same thing in my junior year. I thought, well, what I really want to do is to work on big projects, dams and electrical plants and so forth. So I hitchhiked up to the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I got a job working in the blasting crew and with the manager there. And I love the work. I mean, working on, you know, we had 200 feet of concrete and so forth. Was fabulous. Then I looked around and I said, whoops, these guys live in trailers for 10 years. And by the way, St. Lawrence Seaway was built in a place much better than being in the jungles of Venezuela or the mountains of Pakistan. So, you know, I tested that. So I want kids to have this vocabulary where they come up and they write down and say, this is what I want to test. And finally, you can find what you really want to do, because life is marrying your passions and your principles and your partners to some kind of a wave that happens. And in my case, the wave happened to be Wall Street. I took over a firm in 1983. Okay. I did very well. We grew it 20 times. But you know, while I was there, the market went up 10 times. So the wind was at my back. So if you look at any successful person, they get caught up in some kind of wave or theme or cycle. So I want that inner voice to be productive, because in many cases, most people's inner voices are just a lot of jumbled cacophony, as they say. But I want to go back. What are my passions? Have I exercised them? Do I things that I really want to know? In fact, as kids today will live to 100, they're going to have to pivot a number of times. They're going to have to go back and look at some of their other passions, or other interests, other enthusiasms, because some of the things they're doing will change so much that they won't be available. I always use the music analogy, you know, where when I was a kid, it was black records, then it was cassettes, then it was discs, and now it's in my phone, you know. So you got to keep moving. And AI is going to change that even one step further, one order of magnitude greater. So that inner voice is very important. And you essentially talks all the time to you. And, you know, and you have to really get it under control. I mean, I've my inner voice when I play golf says some things he shouldn't say.
There you go. Yes, absolutely. I think we all have. It's knowing what part, when to listen to the inner voice and when not to, right?
It should be your buddy. It should be your friend, and you should be able to use it, because most of the people talk to themselves all the time. It's throughout your life. How do you make decisions? It's that you and the inner voice make it. Now, I also believe in writing things down. It's the only definite form of communication. Not as definite, but thinking is fuzzy. Talking is very fuzzy. Talking is fuzzy, but when you write it down and look at it, that's why I think it's very important. Writing my book opened up all kinds of things for me that I learned about myself.
Absolutely.
But I'd written, I used to have what I called my me pad, a yellow pad where I used to write down how I made decisions. So that's how I came up with the four P's.
And it is actually, I'll agree with you on that. Since you've written some great, you've had the four P's book, hopefully I'm saying it correctly. Tell us the full title of that book, Ed.
It's called The Island of the Four P's. It's about a young man who arrives on an island, meets an older man who's not a teacher, but a guide. And they guide him to four different villages where he goes through the process of studying his passion, studying his principles, looking at his partners, and finally writing his plans. And I believe that's what people have to go through for the first step, you know, of trying to plan themselves, trying to think through what they want to do with their lives. And, you know, you're not going to help everybody, but if it helps 20-30% of young people, I'm going to be happy. But, you know, some people are going to always want to look at something differently. But this is a process which you can go through. One of the schools that I put it with, forcing the kids to do three different scenarios, which I think is fascinating, forcing them to think of three life paths. So one path they may someday pick up 20 years from now because they thought about it back then.
Right. And I like this, you know, go after what you're passionate about. One of the movies you said,
it's what drives you. You know, you get excited about something. I don't know about you, but when I worked for 50 years on Wall Street, I loved it. I couldn't wait to get up in the morning, go to work, and, you know, have something happen at the office and so on. Tough business, but something I really love to do. And I love running things. And of course, once you decide you want to do something, you have to have the characteristics of it. I mean, I wanted to manage people. I wanted to, and I learned the way you manage people is I have it up on my wall. But basically, I found that what I was successful is I loved having people do better than they thought they could. So when people worked for me, they felt that I was. So the first thing you do is you don't take any credit. Person can basically accomplish almost anything if he or she doesn't take the credit. But then I extended that one step further. I started to deflect credit in my middle career. People would say, "Ed, you've done a great job." I said, "No, yeah, thank you, but no, it's Jose and Mary." And then you get a trifecta, and you get into a habit of doing that. Because, by the way, nothing is ever done alone. Anybody gives you credit for something and you take it 100%, you're wrong. You know, I was kidding about this morning. I was on a podcast this morning. And I said, you know, I talked to the lady who was in charge of tech. And I said, he couldn't do it without you because I was on television. She said, you're right. No, so that's sort of the process that I think is very important. And I've gone through it quite a bit. But it's in this four P's, there are four parts of life that I lay out in my book too: self, family, work, and community. Community is my work, giving back. And one has to take those four P's and put them into each of these four parts of life. And the people say, well, you got to have balance. Well, there's no such thing as balance. By definition, if you focus on one part of your life, you're going to be out of balance because you're neglecting other parts. So it's not balance you're looking for. It's harmony. And that's somebody give me that semantics. Harmony between the two parts and constant recognizing if you're out of balance, because you're always out of balance. Question is how much out of balance. And on Wall Street, as you know, one of the problems you have with divorce is people get caught up in their work and they spend years not paying attention to their family, and then they end up with no family. That's one of the things that I see. I saw that just many, many times. So I have advice for young marriage too. I was at a speech at a university. A young man came up and said, how did you stay married so long? I've been married for nearly 60 years. And I said, some one word is listen, but the other word is spend time alone with that person so that she never becomes a stranger or he never becomes a stranger. And that's what I found out in my work in Wall Street, is that the guys would end up with 3 or 4 years working very hard and turn around and be living with a stranger. It was over by then. But anyway, I wandered on again. Sorry.
No, these are good insights. And just of the things that you've said, Ed, let me just, you know, in your book, you said, by being alone, I developed self-reliance and not afraid to be self-directed. Well, from someone who very young was alone a lot because you were in an orphanage or if, you know, wherever you were in the foster care system, but then to getting to a point where you now managed people. And then you took it a step farther where you said, look, don't take the credit. And then you rounded somewhere around later on, you said, I even deflected the credit.
Deflect the credit. It really works.
Not really me. It's, you know, it's Jose or Mary or whoever it was that you said. And going from that point of like, well, hey, being alone to being a manager of people and doing it so gracefully and doing it where you're giving credit to others. Wow. My hat's off to you.
That's well, you know, you do say, I believe in flow. You do certain things and they start to work. You know, I learned this in college. I started a humor magazine, you know, and I found out that I really loved helping people do better than they thought they could. The guy who do cartoons, I couldn't draw a straight line with a ruler, but I helped him get that job done, and it got me excited. I didn't find that out till later on in my life. You know, I evolved things. I was at first a pretty tough, you know, personal. I wanted the credit, and I wanted, you know, you got to pay me and so forth and so on when we're doing the job. But I started to recognize that wasn't the best way to go if I really was going to exercise my passion, which was to take people, as I did in the humor magazine, and create something, create a product, create a program, solve a problem. And all of a sudden that worked. And so that I evolved that. And that's why Herman Sells was a happy place. I can say that without being very modest, because we all work together. Also, lots of other things in being, you know, learning to be a leader. I always found People said, I want the power and I want the money. I said, you can only have one. If you really want the power, if you want to be the boss, you know, make sure that everybody else gets paid really well, especially your real good performers. Like for example, you know, I was the largest shareholder, but I was not the highest paid person for 20 years, although I was the CEO or the managing partner. And that's very important. People, you know, the great salesman or great banker, he made more money and that was fine because he deserved it. I didn't do that much. I didn't produce as much, physically. So that's another whole arena, but
being willing to share the wealth to be willing to be enough to say, hey, I don't need to be the top paid person. That's a principle of success as well.
Right? Yeah. There's you have, because each person has his own unique situation. That's why this course that I've created, each school has a unique population and they've got to dress up my course to fit their particular school. I have a school in Newark and a school in Greenwich, Connecticut, pursuing these. They're going to have different, it's going to be a little different because kids ask different questions and they have different outlooks and so forth. But this is something that, you know, it changed my life. So I really want to help this, that critical period between 17 and 25, that's where or midlife crisis. You know, I want something where they can go back and they say, you know, I think everybody can take that and say, what are my passions? What are my principles? You know, who are my partners? And then in my planning part of my book is I have you go through this historic experience in an exploratorium. You go up and down. You look at the drivers of the world. You know, I look at simple things like geography. I mean, my middle son went to Denver and became an architect and went into real estate. Well, for the last 40 years in Denver, you've been pretty good in real estate. I go one step further. One of my classmates at business school went to Hong Kong and went to real estate with his father back in 1964. He's pretty wealthy today because you got the wind behind you. And that's why I said that having a chance to study all the things you might do. And today, I mean, what's criminal is that people don't understand there's more opportunity today than ever before. It's more complex, more difficult, but there is more opportunity. Think about AI, robotics, nanoscience, biotechnology. I mean, I was reading about a company that makes rain now, so we can solve things like the fires in Los Angeles and so forth. So, you know, there's so many things that people can do if they want to do them.
That's awesome. Well, I think this is amazing. Again, Ed, the author of On the Road Less Traveled, also the author of The Island of the Four Ps, and we've talked a little bit about your background. Thank you for being with us today. How can people get a hold of you if they want to?
Well, you know, fortunately, my publicist, which I never knew I had to have, has done a robust job on my website. It's just, and Ed Hageum, luckily, there's the only a few Hageums in the world, me and my children. So if you pump in Ed Hageum into Amazon, you get my two books. If you do, you know, www.edhageum, you get this robust website, which means you probably won't have to read the books. Both books, by the way, are on Audible, which is wonderful. The Island of the Four Ps is about 2 hours, and she put six voices on it. So it's really kind of fun. And I think that a fable allows you to do your own thinking or traps you into your own thinking. So either one of those are kind of fun. I've had I didn't know anything about the publishing business. It's the worst market in the world. I lose about $10 per book. So I've sold about 20,000 books, which I think the publisher says that's a lot. I don't know if it's a lot or a little, you can contact me both by, and in my website, it lays out quite a bit of information. You can buy the book on the website as well. And I appreciate if you would buy the book, give me a little rating and review that my publisher says that's important. So thank you.
Wonderful. So we'll put that on the show notes as well. EdHageum.com. That's EdHageim.com. EdHageum.com. Ed, it's been an honor to have you on the show today. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been fun. And thank you for your example. I may use that someday about my friend who has the 5-year-old.
Thank you. Appreciate it.